The Nickelodeon Animation Podcast is brought to you by Cabbage Merchant Cabbage, the best cabbage in all the Earth Kingdom. If you're going to buy cabbage, why not purchase cabbage from the surprisingly knowledgeable merchant of cabbage, the Cabbage Merchant? And now totally free of cabbage slugs, only in the Earth Kingdom. Cabbage Merchant Cabbage.
Oh, my cabbages!
New location carts opening up in the Fire Nation this fall.
Nick, 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 Nick.
Nickelodeon!
From Nickelodeon Studios in Burbank, California, this is the Nickelodeon Animation Podcast. Hi guys, welcome to the Nickelodeon Animation Podcast. I'm your host, Hector Navarro. I'm a huge fan of animation. I'm an enthusiast. I'm also a former Nick intern. That's who I am, but you're not here for that. You're here for some really, really cool creators and talent talking about the shows that they've been working on here at Nick. I don't think there's anything better than talking to creative people about their passion and about their work. So whether you're an animation industry professional or just a huge fan of animation or hopefully both, I think there's going to be something for you. Joining me in the booth today are two guys who are responsible for creating a modern classic in the world of animation, Avatar The Last Airbender and The Legend of Korra, both created by Brian Knitzko and Mike DiMartino. I am a huge, huge fan. I cannot wait to ask these guys a whole mess of questions. Let's just get right into it. I'm gonna try not to geek out too much.
Okay. I mean, that makes
I'm
it
a
more
professional. It makes it more interesting? Okay, great.
I don't know. Like, if you're enthusiastic about it seems more interesting.
Here's where I want to start, because this is one of my favorite questions to ask to anybody that works in animation, is where did the love come from? Do you guys remember your first memory of animation?
First memory of animation?
Supposedly, I don't totally remember this, but the first movie that I ever saw, my parents brought, or maybe it was just my mom brought me to see Pinocchio, apparently, when I was like four.
That's
or something.
That is a big movie for a lot of people. That's a big first movie for a lot of animators.
But I don't remember a lot about it other than the giant whale thing and the sea and everything. So maybe subconsciously that had some influence on me.
I'm not
totally sure.
I lived in a very, and this wasn't like an intentional omission, but a very non-Disney family. We just did not watch that stuff. So I saw Pinocchio years later and was like, "This the effects animation's insane."
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I had more of like an animator's appreciation of
totally.
Than like a kid's wondrous magic or something. But I would say for me, Electric Company, it's probably some of the first animation.
That's true. I remember like Sesame Street too had those
Sesame Street
claymation little things and stuff.
Yeah.
It was animation was something I've always been interested in, but. Mm-hmm. Like, I grew up in Vermont, so there wasn't, like, an outlet for learning about it, really.
Right.
Like, I didn't know, other than, like, Disney and whatever,
I
didn't know how you would be an animator. So I was more into, like, fine art stuff, painting and that stuff through high school and even my first year of college. So it wasn't until, like, college years where I realized, like, RISD, Rhode Island School of Design, where we both went, like, had an animation program. I was like, oh, I could learn about animation there. That's cool. I'm going to transfer to this school.
Brian, when did you make that decision of like, cool, I'm going to do animation?
I would say Looney Tunes was the big, you know, the big animation presence in my life and Tom and Jerry and stuff. So that's the stuff that filled my childhood. And then I think the moment when I saw Ren and Stimpy, that was when I was old enough. I think I was around 12.
Yeah.
And I think I was old enough to, instead of just being a kid passively taking it in, that I was, I mean, I'd always been drawing and was always encouraged by my family to be an artist, professionally. Like, they just assumed I'd be an artist, which is awesome, and I know I'm very lucky in that regard. So, yeah, I think right around Ren and Stimpy, I was like, oh, this is something, like, people made. I could be one of those people. So it wasn't set in stone, but that was something I was definitely interested in.
Yeah.
And then after that, it was Batman the Animated Series, and that's when I was in high school, so I was even older.
Yeah.
And again, I was like, "Oh, this is cool. They're actually taking this medium and doing something dramatic with it, even though it's supposedly for kids." And so I really dug it.
What kind of influences were you guys bringing, animation or otherwise, like movie, music, whatever, to your guys' work?
We both had this kind of awakening and turning point when we saw Princess Mononoke.
Yeah.
I had been exposed to Miyazaki when I was at that animation class in Louisville. I think maybe it's hard for kids pre-social media like age to understand, like, you just didn't know about stuff.
It was
harder to know about stuff. Yeah. And you might see it, but you might be like, what was that? I have no idea what I just saw. And there was really no way to ever like track it down.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was hard. Or you had to have someone who like had access to like some kind of like college video shop, you know? Yeah. And like, or I don't know. I just didn't know how to access that stuff.
Yeah.
So this kid showed me Akira. Yeah, that blew me away. He showed me some of it, and then he showed me some of Nausicaa. But I had no idea what it was. It wasn't a name that stuck in my mind.
You literally couldn't Google it. You were what was that?
I was like, there's this melting robot monster and this crazy explosion. And I remember he was like, this is the greatest explosion ever animated. And I was like, wait, he's like checked? Like, not that I thought like he had the official word, but I'm like, how many animated explosions has this guy watched?
How do you know this has got to be in like the top five?
Yeah, I just hadn't thought of like thinking of it that way. So it blew me away, but I didn't really know what it was. And then what happened was the anime stuff I saw after that always left a bad taste in my mouth, because the stuff that was really popular when I was in high school was like incredibly misogynistic. And I hated it. And I saw Akira and I still love Akira, but it always leaves a bad taste in my mouth. There's just, he's like smacking his girlfriend around. There's always this like awful stuff. It's an amazing film, but it's morally pretty like weird. Yeah. And I think he was just trying to paint a really bleak, awful picture of humanity, and I would guess he succeeded. So, but you know, I'm not listing that among the ones I'm talking about. My friends were into like Fist of the North Star, or where it was just like, yeah, he punches him in his head and his head explodes. And I was like, I don't care about that, you know? Or the stuff like I saw Ninja Scroll.
Sure.
You know, and I'm just like, I'm just not into this. Like, why do people think this is cool? Then Mike and I, we as he said, we were working together on Mission Hill, and Dave Filoni was like, oh, you guys got to see Miyazaki. And that was when they were bringing, Mononoke had come out, and then they were bringing it over. And so we saw it apart from each other, but we both saw it like probably at the Lemley. And
Spirited Away.
I was just like, this is what I want to do with my life. Like,
that's
this
great.
Because it was at a point where I was lucky enough to get into the animation industry, but I was getting disillusioned with sitcom stuff.
Sure.
That just wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to do something cool like Batman, something dramatic. Yeah. So we both were like, oh. And then a couple years later, when they brought Spirited Away over, we got to see Miyazaki speak, which was great.
So, Brian, you were working on Invader Zim here at Nickelodeon.
Yeah, Mike and I worked together on a couple shows.
At Film Roman, right.
Yeah. Film Roman, and then Mike took some time off to do his own project, and I ended up coming over here. Because, again, I was feeling disillusioned, and I was like, I don't really want to work on this sitcom stuff anymore.
Yeah.
And I could have stayed on King of the Hill for years.
Sure.
Like 8 years or something. Theoretically, I could have stayed on that long. But I took a 2-month job here just to work on a show that was really inspiring.
Yeah.
Just because I was like, as an artist, I have to follow, you know, that.
That's great. And correct me if I'm wrong, the story is that you got picked to then pitch a show. Is that how it went?
More or less. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I got to know Eric Coleman, who was the head of development at the time. And he was I think he was the executive in charge on Zim. And Zim was crazy. I mean, I learned a ton. It was when Mike and I worked on these sitcom shows. One thing that we both didn't like was like the writers were in a different part of town.
Yeah.
And there was very little dialogue. I mean, since Mike was a director, once a month or every 2 months, he would like go take his show to screen with them, and I got to go with him and see that side of like a little bit.
Yeah,
but there was this huge divide, and
that's really interesting.
It wasn't integrated, and I didn't think there was a lot of respect from those writers towards the animation pre-production people. Similarly, I don't think there was a lot of respect amongst a lot of the animation pre-production people for the overseas animation people. And so that was something. Working on Zim, I got to go over to Korea by myself for 3 weeks and to meet those crews and to help train them to draw the Zim style. And I already did have a lot of respect for them, but I was just blown away. I'm like, these people are amazing. I don't think they're being utilized to their full potential because of the system that's set up. And Mike and I discussed this a lot. So honestly, creatively, we wanted to do Avatar, but we also had all these like animation production ideas that we wanted to try out. And that was a big motivator too. Was like, okay, we've worked on other people's shows and, you know, good and bad situations in terms of production. And we want to try out our own ideas.
Okay, Gurr, our mission begins now. Let us rain some doom down upon the filthy heads of our doomed enemies.
I gotta sing the doom song now. Doom, 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 doom.
Please, please, please tell me about the pitch for Avatar The Last Airbender, because I know it was unconventional, and it's a great story, so...
Well, much like me in the podcast, I talk a lot, and that's how the pitch went. So I think the main thing is, if the story is good, if the characters are good, if the ideas are good, if you are genuinely passionate about it, I think it can be unconventional. And it's not that we set out to have an unconventional pitch. We just did it the way that felt natural.
We didn't know what we were doing either. Like, we just kind of, we had things planned, obviously, but in a way, we, like...
So you guys went in a little bit unrehearsed, like you sort
totally.
Of...
Totally.
Okay.
Totally unrehearsed.
The advice, do it like the pitch you would give to your friend the night before
that's
the meeting.
That's a really good piece of advice. That's
and
great.
You're still trying to explain it to them.
Yeah.
But it's not the pitch, you know?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not this like razzle-dazzle thing. Like, do it like you would say to your friend, on your roommate on the couch the night before you're going to go in. So basically, I had a meeting with Eric, and it was not a pitch meeting. It was just like, hey, I heard you're interested in me pitching. I have a creative partner. His name's Mike. It was one of the most important meetings I ever had, and we didn't talk about any specific show ideas.
Ooh,
it was
interesting.
Over 2 hours long, but we just talked about how we were both excited about doing a show with integrity, sincerity, just an earnest, honest show. Eric was awesome. He's like, look, I look for people, not ideas. The ideas will follow. I want to work with you. So if you pitch something, if you guys come in and pitch and I say no, don't worry about it. Come back, pitch something else. Come back, pitch something else. He said the door's open until we get something in production. It was amazing. You don't hear that a lot. So I just set up a meeting. I was like, we'll come back and pitch in a month, even though I had no idea what we were going to pitch. 2 weeks, Mike and I scratched our heads, pulled together all the sketches, ideas we had. And then we had the idea for Avatar, developed it for 2 weeks. I drew like a madman in those 2 weeks. Mike was working full time. I was working on this full time. And then we went in and Mike's like, all right, you never shut up, so why don't you talk? Why don't you do the talking? So
good.
I did. One of the things they were looking for was action, adventure, legends and lore. And he's like, I want action. Mm-hmm. I want adventure. I want magic. So I had an illustration for each of those words in color. Just on, not like on a fancy board. I just put them on the table. And then I had a bunch of loose leaf, I think original drawings. I just brought like 45 drawings that I had done, just black and white. And just laid them out on the table. That's another thing I recommend to people, because while you're blabbing on, they can play with stuff, move stuff, and something you're saying can... inspire them to look at something. But if you have this whole PowerPoint, you're like limiting what they can imagine, you know?
People like to use their hands.
Yeah, so I think the less formal, the better. 2.5 hours long.
Yeah.
I just went on and on. And I'm not kidding. I was on the sentence, and then they invade the Fire Nation.
Yeah.
or they secretly, you know, infiltrate the Fire Nation. And Eric just goes, stop. This is awesome, but I've reached total brain saturation. And this is my priority project.
Your destiny. This is incredible. You will be involved in a great battle. An awesome conflict between the forces of good and evil. A battle whose outcome will determine the fate of the whole world.
Yeah, I knew that already. But did it say anything about a girl?
So you guys had like the 3 seasons for Avatar planned right from the get-go.
In 2 weeks,
In 2 weeks, and you had this sort of finite ending.
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit. I mean, that's not a common thing to sort of have an ending for a cartoon show, especially.
Going in, we had already always thought of it as 3 seasons. Originally, it was like 12 seasons
each,
or something. But,
You
know, obviously they wanted more per season. Which was fine. It worked out. But we still always had that like 3-season arc thing. I guess because, we were thinking of it more as this continuous story, which was also totally different for Nickelodeon at the time. Yeah. And I don't know. It was just the type of art and natural inclination to tell the story that way.
Great. Yeah.
And there was no reason they should have agreed to do that. But
well, one thing.
Eric thought it was awesome.
No, yeah. It's great. Like, ever since the beginning, like, we were given the kind of creative freedom to like try out all these new things that weren't necessarily typical Nickelodeon type show.
Totally.
Well, they were cautious about it, but, sure. But they let us do it.
Well, you mentioned earlier, Brian, you mentioned Batman the Animated Series.
Yeah.
Which is a pinnacle of action stuff, you know, but it's from the perspective of an adult.
Yeah.
And I think that the thing that makes Avatar so Nickelodeon is that it's kid POV, right. Kid POV. That's
well,
something
that
you
is,
guys...
That is what, in that really important lunch meeting I have with Eric, the number one thing he said was kid POV.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I like didn't know that, but he just put such a spotlight on it.
Sure.
That I, so much so, that I went home, took a drawing I had done late at night on Zim, and looked at this 40-some-year-old main character and just shrunk him down, made Aang, and he stayed bald.
Yeah.
That was how Aang was born. So, I mean, Aang was born right after that meeting.
Yeah.
And so that was really important. But Eric drilled that home. He said, I can't tell you how many pitches I take as the head of development at Nickelodeon that are about, like, tax attorneys or about a brothel. Or, you know, and he's like, look, this might be a great show on HBO.
Sure.
What does it have to do with Nickelodeon?
Okay, so you had the story planned out. Question, Mike, question, were there any major story changes that happened as you guys were producing the show? Or did everything sort of stay true to what you guys had envisioned?
I mean, I would say at the core, it was pretty, not everything was like
worked
figured
out.
Out at that pitch.
Sure,
like
sure,
we
sure,
had
sure.
A several month like development process before we even got to like the pilot.
Great.
Where we did a more fleshed out like synopsis of the seasons and stuff.
Cool.
And then obviously then when like, the writers came.
Yeah. On. Like once we got to the actual production and writing of the show, like then it's like, okay, how do we make this kind of idea of these three seasons into individual episodes?
Because so it's sort while, of broad like, arcs.
Yeah. So while like the overall big picture stuff stayed more or less the same, like there are so many new developments along the way and character
characters that our writers either created or completely fleshed out or took in a different direction even the actors took the characters in a different direction.
That's what I'm really curious about. Any specific instances where like an actor did something where you were like, ooh that's cool?
I always point to Jack DeSena, and I think he took Sokka in a totally different direction. Sokka was always going to be, he was just going to be more like wry and like dry, sarcastic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it ended up being, he just ended up being goofier, which was fine. It was fun.
It's very thirst quenching though. Drink cactus juice. It'll quench you. Nothing's quenchier. It's the quenchiest.
Okay, I think you've had enough.
Yeah, I think too with Uncle Iroh, Mako, who played him, like we knew the actor and we'd seen him in a couple films, and like I forget how maybe you were like, oh, he would be a good actor.
Yeah.
I forget how the name came up, but we're like, yeah, that's a cool idea, but he was an offer only situation, like he wouldn't audition. And we're like, okay, that's cool. Yeah, bring him in.
Yeah.
And like, you know, it could have gone a million different ways.
Sure.
Sometimes you bring in actors and they're just not right for the part. But, you know, I didn't really know what to expect. But he brought, like, such a great, like, humor and, like, emotional side to him. And he was just, like...
And I think Aaron Iha's, like, our original idea for Iroh was much more severe.
Mm-hmm.
A bit more tough love. And Aaron just like humanized him, and it was cool because we were able to give him these, you know, like multifaceted. He could be a total warrior kind of.
Absolutely.
Like,
you're looking at the rare white dragon bush. Its leaves make a tea so delicious it's heartbreaking. That, or it's the white jade bush, which is poisonous.
We need food, not tea. I'm going fishing.
Delectable tea or deadly poison?
You guys have been talking about it. You assembled an incredible team of talent to develop Avatar, and then the same for Korra. But I really want to highlight Sifu Kisu, his contribution. I felt like the detail in the martial arts added an incredible level of realism. It grounded so much of the sort of fantasy world. So
I was, I mean, once we pitched it, we just knew right away. I was like having worked on Zim, which was comedy action, but you know, it was an action show. And nothing against Zim. They were not anatomical. You know, they were like spindly little characters, and we weren't doing like a martial arts show. It's fine. But anyways, just having worked on that, I knew like the scope of the action we were going to be doing, and the fact that Mike and I were solidifying this idea, it's going to be martial arts. It's going to be traditional Chinese martial arts. So, you know, most people don't know a lot about that. And I had studied stuff as a kid, but like, and watched movies, but it doesn't make you an expert. And it doesn't, you know, when you storyboard something, you have to sort of like, it's like a visual language. And so anyways, it was just like, we're going to need a consultant, and I wanted to learn it so that I could explain it and think with it and use it creatively. That was the thing. So I went to different Kung Fu classes around town, there are a lot of good martial artists in any city, but I needed to find someone who could be creative with it. It wasn't just like, these are the moves, this is the way we do it. And so I didn't end up in one of the strip mall Kung Fu places. I ended up in this guy's backyard.
Yeah.
Like, really far from my house. I was like commuting over, you know, I was just developing Avatar. And then in the early evening, like driving all the way over to the other side of LA to this guy's backyard with a small group of dedicated students. And
cool.
And and I took the class for a little while just to get a feel for it and to get a feel for Kisu and see if, you know, it seemed like it was going to work out. And then, but we finally sat down. He knew why I was there. And we finally sat down. I told him the basic premise, and immediately he started having all these creative ideas. Like, I remember one of the first things he said, he's like, oh, you could have like a tornado, you know? And I was like, I honestly hadn't thought of that, you know? And it was cool. And then he started talking about how different styles could be applied to the different elements. And and I was just figuring it was all kind of one, not that, I knew that there were different styles.
Right.
But I specifically picked Northern Shaolin because I needed a style of animation that would translate, that would be very balletic and dynamic. And some are more subtle and compact. And Mike and I just knew from animation, like on TV animation, subtle and like it doesn't come across. So I needed like really big changes of poses and stuff. So I thought, I picked Northern Shaolin specifically because it will translate well. Mm-hmm. And then Kisa was the one who was like, you know what? I think we could use that for this, but what about Tai Chi for this and that? And so, you know, he was the one who brought those specific characteristics. And then it was cool because that ended up matching the personalities of the writing we were doing like for those nations and cultures and stuff. So.
That's awesome.
More ferocious. Imagine striking through your opponent's heart.
I'm trying.
Now let me hear you roar like a tiger Dillo. That sounded pathetic. I said roar.
So guys, you're finishing, you're wrapping up Avatar. What was the idea, the inspiration for returning to the world and doing Legend of Korra? How did that come about?
Economy crashed.
Yeah, it was a mix of things. I mean, we had, toward the end of Avatar, we had this one Avatar-ish idea that never ended up going anywhere. But, you know, we had started thinking of other ideas, but didn't really pan out. And then, so we were off for like a year and a half or so, and we were writing other set like spec feature scripts. We wrote a couple of those together. And
cool.
And then through, you know, in the meantime, during that break, like Nickelodeon, you know, kept coming back a couple times, like, would you guys want to do something else? We're like, well, how serious are you about this something else thing? And they're like, we're not sure yet. But then finally, they came back and said, we want to do a miniseries, like 12 episode thing.
Great.
Are you guys, you can do whatever you want as long as it's, you know, there's bending, Avatar world.
As long as there's bending.
Yeah, they said we greenlit a miniseries, but it could be a couple miniseries.
Sure.
Like these cycles of 12.
Yeah, yeah. But at the time, they were like, we'll definitely do this.
Yeah.
Yeah, these. So it was a much more firm commitment, you know. It was
totally.
Like, really firm. They're like, we've greenlit it. Like, yeah. It's already happening.
Just please do it.
Yeah. Honestly, that
so, yeah, it was hard.
That's great.
Hard to turn that one down. So, yeah, we knew we didn't want to do just go back to Aang and
sure.
that story and sure. do something new. So and we then jumped ahead to the next Avatar.
That's awesome. Aang. I think that's a fantastic decision. It was obviously great.
While we were doing it, though,
yeah.
before Korra came out, because, you know, it takes forever, and we were, I don't know, a year and a half before any trailer or anything came out.
I mean,
we used to get 1 to 5 letters a week telling us to stop. From fans, yeah. they were like, "We do not want this.
The new project.
Right. New project. Wow. We do not want this.
That's
I just
amazing.
Want Aang. We have a Russian Federation of fans who have signed this petition to get you to stop
because they wanted Aang.
And we wow. always thought the network would want that too. And they yeah. surprised us. They said, "Nah, whatever. As long as it has bending, it's in the Avatar world." Like Mike said,
I think it's great. I think that you guys told your story with Aang. You told the story.
Yeah, that was
I think
our point.
That was the point.
And then stuff that was lingering or stuff that you could revisit, you guys did it in the comic books. Yeah. Like, you know, everybody wins. And I love that the story of Korra jumped forward in time. I think that's incredible world building. It's fantastic. And also, just as a side note, thank you guys for having a female lead. And sure. I know that maybe that was a bit of a struggle, maybe not. But, like, I appreciate and the fans appreciate you guys even kind of vouching for that, fighting for that, you know?
It's yeah, important. It was, I mean, amongst Mike and I, that wasn't a struggle. We were sure. like, I was like, "Hey, what if it's a girl?" Yep. Okay. You know, cool. like that was as long as we talked about that yeah. between us. But then, yeah, you know, just like anything, there was some pushback. But, you know, now I hear there's a lot more of that stuff happening.
Totally.
And if we had anything to do with that. And, I mean, there's also, I think, a zeitgeist. You know, there's a lot of huge movies yes. and book franchises that are have female leads, and it's about damn times.
What makes you so sure your daughter is the one?
Korra, please come in here.
I'm the Avatar. You gotta deal with it.
What kind of lessons did you guys learn on Avatar that you're like, "Cool, nope, not doing that," as you went into Korra?
We learned no lessons, apparently.
None.
Well, because the one thing we thought we learned, I don't know if we really did, was like, we're like, okay, it's this miniseries, it's only 12 episodes, but we won't do a traveling show. Like, we want to...
Sure.
Because that was part of one of the reasons Avatar was so hard, is yeah. every week, every couple episodes, you're in a new place.
Yeah.
New designs, new characters, everything. So we're like, well, at least this way... I mean, even though it's a big city, it's like one location,
yeah.
one main location.
Yeah.
But
Brian's shaking his head.
But
no.
It's a giant metropolitan city, which
yeah.
every episode was a new part of the city. Yeah. And every city shot is like tons of buildings and a crazy suspension bridge.
Hey, it looked beautiful. Looked great.
Well, but it nearly killed us.
Yeah, and then the other problem was like, we're like, well, it's only 12, so we're going all out. Let's just
do
this one thing.
But then it was 12.
And then it's like, oh, well, we could do more, I guess. And each season got a little more crazy and ambitious, of course.
And then third season, we're like, hey, let's do a traveling.
You guys talk a little bit about going into the finale for Korra, what you guys were feeling like. Again, another sort of wrapping up.
Pain.
Okay, great.
It was tough because a lot of it was just, we set a very high bar for ourselves.
Sure.
And I think that Avatar was hard, but then we came back and we're like, but we could do all this better. You know, there were all these art direction goals I had from the making the art book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Beautiful books.
Which was great. A nice sort of like, We had enough time away from Avatar, and then when we came back to do the art book, I was very proud of the work everyone had done and that we had done. But we always were modifying our process as we were going, and we got this Matt Gabois, this amazing After Effects artist in house, mm-hmm. which was a huge, huge boon to Korra that mm-hmm. we didn't have on Avatar. We added all this whole like lighting step to try to get more cinematic lighting, and we just did a lot of stuff like that. But going into the finale, so there were just these like challenges that we had set for ourselves, and there were also just these huge production just snags we had run into. The thing is, there's so much overlap. I mean, at one point we were working on 30 episodes at one time and on Korra, and so when something gets delayed, mm-hmm. it snowballs. And mm-hmm. So there were things as the art director while we were doing the end of book four,
yeah,
that I was like still paying for like crimes from like season one.
Sure.
It was, and that stuff, like we were still behind. Mm-hmm. I basically just lived behind for years, for 4 out of the 5 years or something. And so,
well, yeah, I think too, the reason why it's hard to describe like the finale thing, it's stretched out over such a long period of time. Like there's the writing of the finale,
right,
which is a moment.
Yes.
But then like after that, since it was the end, like the writers leave. And then,
yeah,
and
yeah,
then
the storyboard artists.
And then one by one, like there's these like milestones along the way, but it's spread out over the course of, you know, 8 months or 10 months or whatever.
Oh, longer, year and a half. Yeah.
So you have like all these so many goodbyes, yeah, like during the thing. And then by the end, it's just me and Brian over in Korea, you know, like doing retakes on the final episodes with the crew over there. So,
yeah,
and we had a finale party over there.
Yeah.
So like,
cool.
It's a very long, drawn out process.
It's not just like a one and done. Sure, sure.
No.
Sure.
Raymond Chandler, the long goodbye.
Yeah.
It's kind of a long goodbye.
This must be really, really difficult because you guys have such great fan interactions, but do you have a specific one that stands out? Something that you're like, that was a great fan moment? Or maybe something early on where you realize, oh, this is going to be massive with people and they're really connecting with it. Yeah.
Every outing we do, there's some really amazing, intense personal
experience. Yeah, and I'm always like, I'm amazed that people feel okay with like just talking about that with me and Brian and like sharing that. I mean, some people even share it, you know, in a Q&A with a bunch of people listening.
Yeah.
And like, so the fact that people that it's had that kind of effect on people, like, is definitely beyond anything I would have imagined it having. And then that people are able to share that with us and let us know, like, is very,
it's beautiful,
very touching.
It's so intense. Cool. And, you know, the ending of Korra really brought out a lot of that, and seems to still have, you know, just like the 1 year anniversary of the finale was not too long ago, and I read a lot of amazing stuff. It's amazing how art can have that powerful of a place in people's lives.
Yes,
you know, and Mike and I don't sit down like, how can we change the world? You just have to start with your own heart and like what inspires you and what and respecting the characters that you've all created together, like treating them with respect and like writing and drawing things that you think that character would actually do and like who she or he, you know, who they are. Then I think if you're lucky and if everybody did a good job and all the stars aligned, then like you might reach people.
Can you tell us a little bit about your upcoming projects? Brian, can you tell us about Thread Worlds?
It is sort of a fantasy science fiction thing, but it's an attempt to do hard science fiction. There's no magic.
Okay.
It's very much about science. And it sort of reflects and parallels the history of scientific discovery, philosophical enlightenment, and development of civilizations on Earth told through fictional worlds. So
some light reading, it sounds like.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm trying to bring... I'd say the first book is kind of middle grade, you know, like Avatar was, sort of aimed at that, but again, hoping it has a broader appeal. So yeah, it's been fun. It's like research I'm interested in. It's subjects I'm very passionate about.
Yeah.
So I'm motivated to do the research. And
when can people expect to look at it and read it?
Well, I'm supposed to finish this first volume like early next year,
this
year, early next year. And then it takes them 10 to 12 months to get the book out. So I would say late 2017, early 2018. I don't know if my publisher probably doesn't want me to say that, but one of those.
That's awesome. Mike, can you tell us about your writing project, Rebel Genius?
Yeah, I'm writing a 3-book series.
Cool.
Also middle grade aged, but much like Avatar, we'll hopefully expand beyond that. It's a fantasy set in a Renaissance-inspired world.
Cool.
Where kids and artists have these things called geniuses, which are like a physical manifestation of creativity.
Oh, cool.
In the form of different types of bird creatures.
Cool.
And the magic in the world is based on sacred geometry. So like different shapes having different powers. And so the kids are able to actually, through their genius, manifest these this light attacks and abilities and stuff.
That's awesome.
But it is very, has an action adventure element very to cool. it.
Tons
like a quest.
Of action.
Tons yeah. of
So there's
okay,
art,
cool.
there's action, creativity, right. spirituality.
So, Brian, it's good. It's
I
good.
Read
Brian,
it.
Brian did read it.
It's amazing.
He says,
it's
awesome. Okay.
Oh, it's more than pretty okay. It was amazing. Yeah. Well, so Mike's book's actually done.
Yeah.
He has a
yeah,
physical
so I just,
copy.
Yeah, yeah. We got the advanced copies. So October 4th is the publishing date. The other thing we should mention too is I'm writing graphic novels for Legend of Korra.
Oh, also. So cool.
Like,
yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
we have the Avatar graphic
Correct,
novels.
Correct. Yeah.
Through Dark Horse. Yeah.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. Very we're going to also start that series with Korra. So
that's awesome. A lot of fans are really excited about
that.
Yeah.
So those
really
will be
excited.
Out for. Another
yeah,
while.
I think it got a little delayed.
So that's awesome.
But
guys.
Those are in the works as
cool.
well.
Cool. What is your favorite thing about working with the other guy in this room?
Well, I will say I miss working with Mike. And we didn't. It's not that I was like, oh, I want it done
sure.
right. I got to do it alone. It was
sure.
more like, man, I want to test my own mettle. I want to see if what I can do by myself. But one thing that was really hard was when I sat down to write everything Mike and I wrote. Was born from discussion.
Yeah.
We would come in with maybe a scrap of an idea,
yeah.
or sometimes no ideas, and just discuss. And having already been friends, and then we worked together, and then we were creators together, we just very lucky to have cultivated this really nice, I think it was nice, working relationship.
I would agree with
that. And, and then when I got to the, Mike read my, fleshed out outline of my book, and, I was having a hard time with some of the notes, man, I don't know how to address this stuff. And then we sat down and just talked over lunch, and I was like, oh, this is like working with Mike again. This is great. It just felt so nice. And
that's awesome.
So just kicking around ideas with Mike was just awesome. And I always say this and I mean it. I don't think there was an idea either of us had that didn't get better.
Mike, what's your favorite thing about working with Brian?
I had a very similar experience with my book and coming up with ideas where it's you do get used to this, collaboration, and then it's just you. So so you don't have in times where, you might not have an idea, the other guy takes over for a little bit and might come up with something and that'll spark something else. But when it's just you, you're just I've been thinking about the same thing for forever. But definitely I would say Brian's the thoughtfulness and attention to detail of stuff that he goes into is very influential. Just as far as making sure it all makes sense, let's make sure all our pieces are connected.
Yeah.
And,
we used to call that making it bulletproof.
Yeah.
Way back, before the Avatar pitch, we would always, it was sifting it back and forth until... We had patched up as many of the holes as we could.
Bulletproof. Yeah. I love it. Guys, I cannot thank you enough.
Thank you.
This has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Michael DiMartino. Thank you so much, Brian Konitzko.
Thank you.
I'm going to leave you with this. I forgot to do this at the beginning of the thing.
He's taking his clothes off.
I'm taking my shirt off. I'm actually taking my shirt off. I completely
tattoo.
Forgot.
Full chest tattoo.
Boom. No, I wore the,
oh,
I wore
cool.
the shirt.
I've
I wore
that.
The shirt.
That's
and
awesome.
I think, you know what? I'll keep my shirt on because I'm not going to freak these guys out with my fandom right away. But so much fun, guys. Thanks
awesome.
So much
Thank
for coming
you.
In.
Thank you.
I hope you guys enjoyed my conversation with Mike and Brian as much as I did. I tried really, really hard not to geek out on them too much, but I'm a huge fan, so what can you do? You're not going to want to miss an episode of the Nickelodeon Animation Podcast, so please, please, please visit nickanimationpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts for more episodes and tons of bonus content, like photos from the podcast of Mike, Brian, and yours truly looking all geeked out in a very rad Avatar t-shirt, I might add, as well as original production art from Avatar and Korra from our very own Nick Archive. Thanks to the awesome crew who puts this podcast together. This podcast is produced by
Jonathan Highlander,
Dana Vasquez Eberhardt, Kelly Smith,
Andrew Hubner.
Original music by Useful Creatures. All of the incredible social media for our podcast is made by
Narbe Manassians, Greg
Nix. And thanks to the man who works at controls and makes me sound better than I have a right to,
Manny Grava.
Until next time, thanks for listening to the Nickelodeon Animation Podcast and keep watching cartoons.